Hi, good morning, and welcome to the Friedberg quarterly conference call covering the second quarter. I'm David Rosberg, and with me this morning is Al Friedberg. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, David.
Al, I think that in deference to the scrupulous Eddie Roach, we should begin by noting the date. And even before that, I think wishing Eddie a good vacation.
Oh,
And
Eddie's on
today,
vacation. Well, that's nice.
Eddie's on vacation. And today is Thursday, the 27th of July. We hope wherever you are that the weather is good. A little bit of housekeeping. We try and keep the call to about 45 minutes, and we remind you that the call will be posted on the Friedberg and the Niagara websites, and you can listen to it on your elliptical trainers at your leisure beginning about 15 minutes after we're done. If you've got any questions, I've got a bunch of questions that are, as usual, posed to us by our investor clients. If you have questions and you'd like me to pose them to Albert, I invite you to text them to me. This is a radical change. In the past, we've said email them to me, but I think that's a bit complicated for a lot of people, so you can text them to me. My phone number is 416-993-4160, 416-993-4160. Okay, Al, let's get right to it. As you say in your second quarterly letter, a positive quarter, but a quiet quarter. And that quiet, I think, mirrors the quiet, dampened volatility environment that we live in. You've talked about, I wouldn't say a seismic, but a significant change in the portfolio. You were fearful of inflation. You had a long position in commodities. You took away that position in commodities, and you stand now starry-eyed in front of negative interest rates that have persisted for a long time and that you think are going to continue to persist. Would that be a kind of adequate summary of the macro terms of the way you're looking at the world?
Yeah, more or less.
So let me start by asking you, do you fear that negative interest rates, having persisted for so long, have created a kind of vicious cycle of deflation? That's to say that by encouraging malinvestment, production facilities, production capacity that wouldn't have existed there, wouldn't have existed otherwise, and as a result, will continue to put pressure on prices.
Okay. Yes. Let me say this: the negative interest rates, they affect, especially affect capital goods, right, or goods that have a long life, and so you will encourage building. Shopping malls, or you encourage building commercial buildings or factories that have long lives. In that sense, Austrian economics will say that these negative rates provide incorrect signals, but they do increase supply, and they increase supply in the intermediate term, and the increased supply eventually puts pressure on goods. Consumer goods that are produced by these capital goods, and therefore there is a deflationary pressure in many consumer goods or in many areas of consumer goods. So yes, it has an inflationary pressure. It has an inflationary effect on capital goods of long life, and it stimulates their creation. And has a depressing effect on the output of these capital goods, so therefore on the consumer goods. Yes.
And do you think that this is a factor that's going to, in keeping with this notion of a vicious circle, continue to pressure interest rates lower? In other words, to continue the cycle of negative rates and increase capacity and continue to put pressure on prices?
It might. It might. I mean, that's not the only reason why we have a generally well-behaved consumer price movement. I mean, the main reason, as I pointed out in the letter, was that even though the central banks have lowered rates and have managed to lower rates to negative rates, money has not increased. Money circulation has not increased at a rapid pace. So we have had fairly well-behaved, actually, money supply growth for the past 7 or 8 years. And this has been generally, I wouldn't call it deflationary, but certainly disinflationary. So that's the main force behind it. This other idea that you pointed out, you know, the fact that low rates can create oversupply, that adds to the problem. And then, of course, is the effect that it has on the minds of central banks who viewing this and seeing this, are going to be very reluctant in raising rates very, very far. We are getting very close in some countries to inverting yield curves. In the U.S., the process had begun months ago. We're not far from closing that gap almost entirely. And we know that inverted yield curves have a negative effect on financial markets. I don't think that it will get to an inverted yield curve in the U.S. because I think the Fed is fairly conscious of this and will probably stop raising rates if the 10-year, for instance, the 10-year bond were to show yields that approach the Fed funds. Right now, I think 10 years is somewhere around 220 or 230. And Fed funds is 1 to 1.25, so there's still some spread. But it's unlikely, and this is what I pointed out in my letter, it's unlikely that the Fed will move beyond where the 10-year bond yields, right? So it's a lid on their aspirations.
Well, in both your funds, you're net long in both the global macro fund and in your unleveraged asset allocation fund. In your asset allocation fund, you're 100% long, but in your global macro fund, you're net long between somewhere around 60 to 80%, it seems, of NAV. And clearly, you have a lot of confidence that equity prices are going to continue to rise. Now, is what you've just described? As we know, let me put it to you this way. As we know, recent economic signals have been weak. It shows a weak economy. Is your sense then that these monetary conditions are a stronger force at work? Is that why you have so much confidence in equity securities?
Yes. It's really the question of what's the choice for a long-term investor. And given the conditions that exist today, and given the fact that real yields are either negative or very, very small positive numbers, like the 30-year TIPS in the U.S. yields something like 1%, and shorter maturities would yield between negative and 50 basis points. So given the fact that that's your choice, that what you can do if you're a long-term investor is put your money in bonds and receive almost nothing in real terms, or buy equities that yield on an earnings yield basis that yield something like 4.5%, I don't think there is much of a choice. I think that the money will continue to flow towards equities. Now, there are of course those who are willing to go up the to take on more risk, and they're willing to buy corporate bonds that yield a little bit more in real terms. But once you do that, you start actually taking on more risk, and for that, you might as well take on the risk of equities, the highest risk, and earn the most amount of money, which is I say 4.5%. So I think that the argument is simply one of choice. You know, there is no choice. And if there is no choice, that's where money is going to keep going.
In your global macro fund, you took off a commodities position, and you've tended to you've tended to be an investor now beyond the U.S. You're starting to find your equity portfolio includes Greek banks now, Japanese junior equities, as well as home builders. Are you finding more diversification in, are you finding that equity securities are less correlated now than they were several years ago? Is this a theme that has emerged? Do you expect to continue to play it?
Okay, there's a lot of points that you just raised in that simple question. So let's see. First of all, the positions that we have in Japan and Greece have been there for many months. I mean, I've been there for more than a year, I believe. So it's not they're not positions that we just took on now. We may have traded around them, increased a little bit. In some cases, we did increase it a little bit. But they've been there, and the reason is that in each case, it's a particular reason for it. I think that generally speaking, equity risk assets, generally speaking, risk assets should do well all around the globe. So it's not a question of whether it will be up. There will that share that say that equities will go up in Japan or Greece. And they'll go down in the U.S. I don't think so. I don't think that the argument of going out of the U.S. is one because we expect the U.S. market not to do well. It's not the case. I think that all of them will do relatively well. The issue is which one will do best or which one will do better. So we still believe that the Greek banks, for example, are very, very cheap in this international context, and that as the situation continues to improve little by little, you'll see the Greek banks trade very close to multiples of book value that you see today in other European countries. That implies a very substantial re-rating for these banks. We're talking about in the hundreds of percent increase. So that's the case, has been the case, and now they have stabilized and they have moved up a little bit, and so we think that they will do very, very well in the next, I don't know when, in the next while. The case of Japanese securities is outstanding. I think that Japan is really one of the great stories, if one can have a great story in this international context. It's got all the right ingredients for a major increase for a major bull market in stocks. Liquidity is been moving up in the system, so now money supply and broad liquidity have been growing at the highest rates of the past 10 years or more. We have a committed Bank of Japan that's committed to maintaining negative rates out 30 years. That's pretty remarkable that you don't find that in most other countries. You have a tremendous exposure to China in the Pacific Rim, which is one of the fastest growing areas in the world. I believe something like 50 or 55% of their exports go to China in the Pacific Rim. This is here's a remarkable factor. Sales in Japan, we all know that there's been some deflation or a little bit of deflation. Not quite true that it's deflation. I think prices have been more or less stable. But sales, corporate sales, have been unchanged. If you look back to 1995, corporate sales are unchanged since 1995. Yet corporate profits have gone up from 25 trillion yen, I saw the number just a few days ago, to 74 trillion yen in the recent 12 years. That means that, and it's at a record high now, that means that corporate profit margins are at the new high, 5.5%, which is very unusual for Japan. It's been a straight uptrend. Some of that has to do also with the fact that Japan cut taxes significantly, and now they're below the U.S. They're around 30%, but some of it has to do with improvement in their productivity and also being helped a lot by the fact that the trade-weighted yen in real terms also a lot since 1995, from, let's say, an index number 150 to about 82. So all the conditions are there for the Japanese market to do well. And one of the things that we have done recently, just recently, we have tweaked the position a bit, and we have moved, we've been moving away from some of the more senior indices that are loaded up with companies that have legacy problems, and almost dinosaurs, banks that can barely make any money making loans, and other companies that have not done well and they've been in business for a very long time. But we've been moving towards the more junior sector of the economy, and that's where you're getting a lot of growth. So that's a great story, right? Another great story.
It is.
Another great story is Brazil, which I think that it's one of the few countries, if not the only country in the world, that has made significant progress in reform. There's no country that has done that many reforms over the past year than Brazil.
And it seems to have survived now a political crisis with
it's surviving a political crisis. Reform. Correct. I believe that one of the reasons it's surviving a political crisis is because there is some consciousness, even among the members of the Supreme Court, that it's best to live with this problem for now, so that this government can pass legislation that's needed. And so they've passed a lot of very, very good legislation in terms of spending. They have a cap, a 20-year cap on spending, which is remarkable. They have passed some labor legislation now, deregulating some of the labor market and making it easier to hire people and to fire people, and that's making a difference. They've passed, just in the last few days, a mining reform. And the one thing that's still missing is the pension reform, but that's coming. So, and there's a lot of privatization going on in Brazil, so we believe that that's still a very bright area to be in Brazil. So again, I'm going to summarize to say that. And by the way, these positions we have had and we've been living with for some time, and they are slowly, you know, being recognized by the market. So we don't necessarily go out of the U.S. because we think that that's what you should do, and we should be in emerging markets and so on. We have gone out only to places and areas that have exceptional growth opportunities or investment opportunities. In the U.S., we remain extremely committed to the home builders story, which is getting better every day. But maybe that's a separate discussion.
Well, why don't we go there? It's a position that you've had now for many years, and it's stubborn.
It's stubborn, but home builders have actually kept pace with the main index, with the S&P, and actually they're starting to show a little bit more strength than the S&P, but I believe that that's just the very beginning of what could be an explosion in equity prices. They are making a tremendous amount of money. I mean, sometimes their margins are a little lower, but the economics are simple. We have almost no inventory of houses in the U.S., extremely low, maybe the lowest in history. That does not allow for increases in sales. So sometimes we see sales are down, and the reason they're down is simply because there's no houses available. But you can tell that that's the case because prices are rising. Prices continue to rise. So if sales are coming down and prices are rising, then you know that what's happening is that you have a shortage of product. And so they're in this market. They have to provide supply. We know that sooner or later the capital system is such that it will always provide supply where price signals are right. And housing starts have begun to move up. They're moving up very slowly. One of the reasons is, by the way, that home builders are finding some problems or headwinds in getting land and permits and labor. So it is taking time to ramp up, but the numbers are exceptional. And, you know, just I think it was yesterday, it was a couple of days ago, and it was just pretty interesting because the largest home builder in the United States, Dr. Horton, DHI, and, you know, we don't get into the nitty-gritty of the numbers when we're dealing on a macro basis, but, I mean, it was pretty remarkable to see their numbers, even though the market was a little disappointed because of the margins, but the profit increases have been exceptional, just exceptional. And the comment of a colleague of mine was that if this was a tech stock, it would be trading at a 40% multiple to the market rather than a discount to the market on a P basis. So these companies are making a lot of money. They will continue to make a lot of money. The market will begin to recognize that the supply demand situation is compelling, and that there's only one way out of this problem that the economy has right now of a shortage of housing, and that is for them to step up the production of houses and to continue making money as they're making now. So I believe that we are on the cusp of a very, very significant up move in this housing sector. As I said before, they have kept up with the main averages, but it's just barely kept up. We have taken a very aggressive position, and maybe this can segue into something that other people have been talking to us about options. We wanted to take a very large position in this sector, and we have an exposure today of maybe 70% of NAV is today in home builders. And the way we have decided to do it is by way of taking positions in long calls, because long-term calls, because obviously the exposure is very large and the risk may be larger in case of a market sell-off. You know, they do have a higher beta than the market. And so we have done it by way of options. We are very comfortable with our position, extremely comfortable, and feel that at some point in the next few months, it will actually go beyond 100% of our NAV, and we will continue to hold the position because we think that prices are still extremely low, extremely cheap, a deal of opportunity there. So that's home builders. So I discussed already home builders. I discussed Japan and Greece and a little bit of Brazil. So, and that's basically our position. We do have a short position in retailers, which seems to be almost like a no-brainer in some retailers, not all retailers, of course. It has done relatively well. We've made a little bit of money. The story everybody knows, so it's not a great something new. The fact is that these companies are struggling now with e-commerce and the pressures of e-commerce, and those that have countered by creating an e-commerce department or business are finding that their margins are getting squeezed badly, and they're finding also that they're stuck with legacy assets that they're going to have to get rid of, and in some cases are very painful losses. So take painful losses. So that's it. That rounds up our position. Fairly large, concentrated positions, and all we're doing now is waiting. We're just very, very patient and waiting. We think we're going to do extremely well the balance of the year.
Okay, I want to circle back a little bit to home builders, so as not to frighten people. When you say that your exposure to home builders is 70% of the NAV, first of all, your total exposure, your total leverage is under three.
Yep,
at around 2.7. Is that
2.5?
2.5. So if you have a 70% exposure to home builders, then about a quarter of the portfolio is exposed to, or a little bit more. But in a way, because you say it's 70%, that's on a delta adjusted basis. It's not that you have a 70% exposure on a delta-adjusted basis because you hold a position via calls.
Right, right. And that means that if the market were to go down rapidly and very significantly, our exposure would be very small very quickly. You know, it would go
exactly.
From 70,
so your risk
to
20, is asymmetric
to 10,
in that way.
Nothing. Well, that our risk is very much protected, right?
Okay. Now, I'm going to put to you a question that was, I think, astutely sent to me by a client, which will act as a devil's advocate to your home builder's theory. And it is that as prices have risen, one would expect that supply would rise to meet the demand. However, is it possible that because the demographics are what they are, that's to say, that you have an aging baby boomer population and a shrinking and an increasing millennial population whose cultural values and whose economic values may be different, that what home builders are looking at is or are experiencing is fearfulness that rising prices are pricing their product beyond the means of the millennial generation, and they're unwilling to take the risk to increase supply, and that explains why it is that supply has been so persistently lagging, that this long expected profusion of profits in the industry is not going to take place.
You know what? That explains very well the reluctance of the market to bid up these companies. And I think that that's the argument. That has been the bearish argument, or at least the restraining argument, about builders. And that's why they did not do better than the market, even though they were in their upward cycle, right? This has been their upward cycle. So that's the argument. The argument is, A, millennials are culturally different than our forefathers were. And B, and they're not owners very often. They like to be renters. B, prices are rising, and that can dissuade them from getting in. So, I don't know about A. You know, I'm not an anthropologist or a sociologist, and I don't know how that works. People do form families after a while, and maybe a little later in life than we used to. And then we'll see whether when they do form families, do they want to have homes? We don't know yet. I guess the story is still a little early. But the other argument, the price rise, that's clear that that's a market mechanism to call out further supplies or to actually try to draw builders to increase supply, and that is a negative. To the extent that prices are rising is negative from the demand side because it rations demand. But my feeling is also that houses in some way have become also... David, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I just heard some noise in the background.
Yeah, me too. I don't know what...
Okay. Houses have become an investment asset. And people are beginning to look at houses as investment assets, or speculative assets. And so I believe that rising prices, when they are so consistent and it's been happening now for 6 or 7 years, almost 0.5% to 1% a month, eventually convinces many people to make the jump and to borrow money. And the thing is that you can today obtain financing at very reasonable rates, at rates that are lower than the rate of appreciation of these homes. You know, you can borrow money around long-term money around 4%, and these homes are rising at an average of 5.5% to 6.5% a year. So from an investment point of view, it makes a lot of sense. You lever it up. There's very few assets that you can lever up like homes, where you can borrow 60, 70, 80% of the money. And so I think that the rising price argument could be turned to a bullish argument, because as long as financing is available at cheaper rates or at negative rates, vis-a-vis the increase in prices of homes, I think they can be turned into a bullish argument. We are actually seeing an increase, a slow but steady increase in the amount of supply. They're building and they're selling. Whatever they're building, they're selling.
Okay. All right. You talked about you're long home builders via call options in the Global Macro Fund. Let's just take a second before we. Well, what I want to do is talk about options generally, because you have a set of protective puts on the global macro, on your global macro portfolio, to guard you against geopolitical risk and sudden shocks to the system. You're not so much worried about a slow decline. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but before we talk about that, let's just speak a little bit about the difference between the Global Macro Fund and the Asset Allocation Fund. It's, you don't have call options. Home builders via call options in the Asset Allocation Fund, or am I mistaken about that? Can you, in any case, could we just speak before we talk about the protective measures that you have in the Global Macro Fund of the difference between the two?
Okay, that's a good question. The Global Macro Fund is leveraged, and as you mentioned before, today we are leveraged around 2.5 to 1, meaning we have $2.5 of exposure to $1 of equity. Being leveraged, you are exposed, or quickly exposed, or easily exposed to sharp shocks. And you know, a market that goes down 10 or 20% can inflict much more pain on a leveraged account than an unleveraged account. As a result, in the Global Macro Fund, we have had to have resort to either taking positions by way of call options, or purchasing protection like puts, out of the money puts in some indices, or buying out of the money calls on the VIX, those kinds of things, because we are so leveraged. So that's in the asset allocation fund. We are not leveraged. We only use what's available to us. And for example, the long position in housing in the Global Macro Fund is equal to 70% of NAV, but it's only equal to 30% of NAV in the asset allocation. So it's already a smaller position, and it's not by way of options, but by way of outright purchases of securities. So there's less of a need, far less of a need to hedge in the asset allocation fund. Far less of a need to hedge. Having said that, there are the defensive measures that one would take in the asset allocation fund should we foresee a real bear market beginning, then are still available to us. For example, we could, if we wanted to, hedge some of these positions, but we are allowed to hedge these positions via let's say, options. The other thing that we can do is we can move very rapidly our portfolio into cash. We can buy bonds. So, again, there is the basic difference between the two funds makes us being a lot more careful with the leveraged fund than with the non-leveraged fund.
Also, you have, if I'm not mistaken, in the asset allocation fund, exposure to gold miners, whereas you don't have a commodity position in the Global Macro Fund, or other than the gold miners, a commodity position in the asset allocation fund. In the back of your mind, is that exposure to gold miners a type of protective measure against something untoward happening globally?
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is, and it's by way of mining equities rather than bullion, because the mining equities give us better protection. There's been a lot of consolidation in the industry. Companies are today more mean and lean. They don't waste a lot of money like they used to do at one time, and there will continue to be consolidation because it's very, very hard to find reserves. So that will continue to happen. Therefore, we think that gold mining stocks offer a good investment opportunity. They have a limited downside, provided the price of gold stays around here or even goes down 10 or 15%. They still have a limited downside, and they have a lot of upside. And the upside includes a sort of a call on any geopolitical event or any event that is what you call a scary event, quote unquote, right?
Right. Okay, let's talk about how you're dealing with a scary event in the Global Macro Fund. You have call options, or you have put options, and they're deep out of the money, and in your quarterly letter you say that you're prepared to give up 30 basis points. Is it 30 basis points a month? I can't quite remember the number, but you're willing to pay up for fear of something catastrophic emerging suddenly and unexpectedly. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, let me differentiate between the two types of option buying that we do. In the case of just plain protection, where we want to have protection, we will spend a little bit of money, not much, buying out-of-the-money options. And a good example would be, for example, we have out-of-the-money call options on crude oil. It's going down. We think crude oil is going down. In fact, we think crude oil is going to be going down to $20. But we have protection in case the price were to shoot up, and the fear is that there could be some kind of a military event, conflict that develops in the Middle East, and that can shut down the Straits of Hormuz, or it can destroy some of the larger oil fields, and the price would very quickly rise. Now, if it does, it would move up very quickly, and these call options would become valuable, and it would offer protection in case of such a thing, which would have ramifications, by the way, not just for oil, but would have ramifications for oil markets. So in that case, you know, we have some nice protection for whatever may happen in the markets. So that's one. Or for instance, we have call options on long term. Call options on VIX. You know, the term structure of VIX is sloped, positively sloped. So options may be very cheap when you're looking at the one-month option, but when you're looking at a six-month option, they're much higher. The implied volatility is much higher. Still, we decided that we're going to be buying some of these out-of-the-money call options on the VIX, saying that if an untoward event were to happen, volatility would increase very rapidly, at least nearby volatility would increase very rapidly, and we would be gain some protection. But in those cases, the oil case, the VIX case, or an S&P out of money put, in those cases, we spend very little money. And it's still little money. It may be as much as sometimes 2 or maybe 3% a year. So we are working against very strong headwinds. You know, those things cost money. And if you were to compare us to a long-only fund that has no worries and no concerns and can sleep very well at night, and is 100% long, and if something happens, they have absolutely no protection. And we have the possibility maybe of either protecting our portfolio or even making money in it, right? So it's hard to compare two products like that, because one product has no protection at all, and of course they will be saving that 2% a year, and that's a lot of money today. And we are paying 2% a year for risk. Now, that's one type. The other type of options that we buy are options where we want to buy, or we want to acquire, not necessarily buy, but we want to acquire a very large stake in a particular industry, like, for example, home builders. And in that case, for us, it's easier, cheaper, more risk-effective to buy options, long-term options, long-term call options, than it is to buy the actual securities. It's true they have a decay, but it's not that significant in the near term because they are long-term options. So the decay begins 2 months or 3 months or 4 months before the option expiration. So for now, in the early stages, you don't suffer a lot of decay because of that. And to tell you the truth, you know, I compare the decay to the possibility that if I buy the security and the market moves against me even by 5 or 8% and I have to get out of the position and it takes time to get out, we have large positions, the cost of getting out is never reflected in an outright long position, but it's quantified when you have these options. So the two types of options, one of them is almost like a throwaway money, like an insurance premium, Somebody has a house, he wants to protect it against fire, he pays a certain insurance, and he hopes that nothing will happen, but he's going to be poorer at the end of the year by the amount of money that he paid the insurance company. That can cost us somewhere, as I say, between 2 and 3% a year. The other cost is really one that allows us, enables us, to take on very large positions, and we don't think that the decay is that linear. So because of that, we don't consider it to be such a cost. It is a cost, but not such a cost. And if you compare it to the outright ownership, it may be very cost effective.
Okay. Last question. You are uncharacteristically bearish on commodities. We've had our Canadian dollar approach its long-term average since it was allowed to float in 1976 of 80 cents. Do you have an outlook on either commodities and its dancing partner, the Canadian dollar?
My commodity outlook is my outlook for commodity prices is not bullish, but I cannot imagine that they will go down a lot from here either, because we are already selling at very low prices. You know, we are selling at the index, for example, that we look at, the VCOM index that we look at, is trading at 50% discount to where it was 20 years ago, practically. So
in real terms.
In nominal terms, which means in real
terms. Nominal terms.
In nominal terms. So it's extremely low. It's extremely low. It's extremely cheap. So chances are that the next major move will be upwards. So I'm not immediately bullish, but I think in the long run you have to be bullish. Now, as to what effect it has on the Canadian dollar, or for instance the Australian dollar for that matter, or the South African rand, or any what they call the commodity currencies, because it in a way right now it depends on which commodity. For example, I think the Canadian dollar benefited from the fact that oil had rallied from the 42 levels to around $50, $49, $50, and oil is an important commodity for Canada. And also the fact that there's been a more aggressive tone on the part of the Central Bank of Canada, thinking that maybe the rates will go up here a little fast in Canada faster than the U.S. None of those two factors are very, very important. The interest rate one is not. I don't think that it's going to do more than what the Fed does. The commodity side of it may be negative for Canada going forward, because most of it is oil. It's oil, and our outlook for oil is for lower prices. So I'm not sure that the Canadian would benefit greatly. Australian dollar may do better. And I've been thinking that Australia against Canada would be a good trade. We haven't put it on, but that seems to me like a good trade, because Australia is a little bit more diversified, and the big exporters of iron ore, and that's had a nice recovery recently, copper, base metals in general, and they're big sellers to China, where they have a very good market there. So Australia is a little bit more affected by terms of trade than Canada would be, and maybe more it would be more supportive for Australia than for Canada.
Al, a CODA question, and then we'll wind it up. You just recently launched or about to launch a Canadian dollar share class of your asset allocation fund, and currency exposure will become a factor for the investor. Can you speak about the way you think about currencies in the asset allocation fund?
Sure. There are a number of determinants. There are a number of factors that go into the return for the asset allocation fund, which is they are the currency in which the fund is invested in, and whether that currency does well or doesn't do well vis-a-vis other currencies. The capital gains that we may be getting and income that we may be getting from the different investments. We are careful about all three of those sources, elements. And so one of the things that we do, one of the main preoccupations that we have when we're managing money in the asset allocation fund is What is the best currency all around? What's the best currency in the world? Or what are going to be the best currencies in the world to be invested in? And so, for example, about 35% or 36% of the money is in Brazilian real, because we think the Brazilian real is one of the best currencies. And 65% is in US dollars, because we still think that all around the US dollar is still okay.
Do you not have any yen exposure there with your position
No,
in
that's
Japanese juice?
not really, because when you're in equities, that yen exposure may or may not be there. Simply because if the yen gets stronger, it could be that the actual security goes down to compensate for it. So it's not clear that there is a real currency exposure there. It's somewhat, a little
Okay.
bit of currency.
Okay.
But it is possible that if we thought dollar or the Australian dollar would do very well and would actually, going forward, be a big winner against the US or against, mind you, the US is sort of our base case or default case. So, but if we thought it would do better than the US, then we can easily adjust our portfolios to be long Canadian, even while we are invested in different assets. We can do that by way, synthetically, right? We can do that by buying futures of Canadian dollars that will cover, quote unquote, cover, protect the portfolio, even while we invest in U.S. securities. So it's a major preoccupation for us. We are constantly thinking about currency. For us, the default is not Canadian, just because we are a Canadian fund. For us, the default is U.S., but that's default, and that's not really where we're going. Where we're going is to see where are we going to find the best currency upside anywhere in the world. And
Good. Okay. Sorry, did I cut you off there?
no, that was fine. That was fine.
Okay. All right. Well, then we're 2 minutes over time. I don't want to take up any more of your time or any more of our listeners' time. I thank you, Albert, for taking the time this morning, and for our listeners for having dialed in. I remind you that the podcast will be put on the Friedberg website and the Niagara website in short order. And Al, take the opportunity on behalf of all the investors to wish you good luck in the coming quarter. You've started off well. We have positive results so far. We hope that when we speak again towards the end of September, that continues that way.
Okay, David, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.